Is our backup in paper 119? We did get it started last time. All we got through is the preface, so we're ready to do section one, paper 119, which is old single column, page 1309. And one little hearken back to last week's study group. Remember at the end I was trying to remember what it was that I was going to connect to the comment that Mo made. The thing I wanted to bring up, I basically talked about it, but I just wanted to have people reflect on. It was interesting, he used the notion of, isn't it wonderful to recognize that we don't have a universe sovereign who lives in an ivory tower, you know, that he's been down here in the trenches with us and knows us as we are, and literally in our case, where we are. And so, remember how I was pointing out, it's like, well, that's worth reflecting on a little bit. That's a very recent phenomenon. The first inhabited planets in Nebadon were 200 billion years ago. And the first bestowal was just a billion years ago. Just. But relative to 200 billion, it's just a billion years ago. So for 199 billion years, inhabited worlds, you know, reached that initial, you know, they had their Andan and Fanta, you know, and went all the way deep into light and life. The whole while, you basically have a universe sovereign, and they all know it, that, you know, doesn't have any real direct experiential, you know, relationship to them. You know, he's never been down there in the trenches with them. He's never been a mortal. So you don't want to, you know, again, be careful about sort of painting the universe in your image. It's a simple example of that. I mean, it's humans don't only have value, you know, relative to the supreme, because they were born post-Pentecost on a world, you know. You know, especially the Pentecost of, you know, Pentecost, quote unquote, if you will, of the Creator Son. So, you know, just it's just a very stark thing to, you know, to recognize. 199 billion years of humans evolving on worlds is a really long time. You know, it's just beyond our comprehension what those first worlds, what kind of, how deep and light and life they are, how beyond our wildest imaginations they are. You know, and they did that long before even the first bestowal that we're going to read about tonight.
They're still the majority by
a lot. Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot more that happened before a billion years ago than after a billion years ago. You know, I mean, obviously the only ones that have happened in the last billion years, you know, come to be inhabited in the last billion years is just a little group. You know, like in our local system, the little group of worlds that, you know, are sort of synchronized with us, you know, they're kind of done in groups. You know, you don't do the whole local system all at once. You're not going to feed all thousand worlds into the mansion worlds all at the same time. They're done, it's done episodically in little groups. You know, it's going to be, even over all of Nebadon, it's going to be fractionally a small number that have happened since. You know, relative to before a billion years ago.
Chris, I've got a question.
Yeah.
At the beginning of the Supreme Papers, you included this paper as part of the ending Pentateuch.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can understand how the first four are linked, but talk about how this one is part of this Pentateuch.
Yeah, well, that's what we're going to, we did it a little bit last week, and we're going to be doing it all the time here. And the first thing we're going to do in that regard is what's next. So let's, before we get into the bestowals, I wanted to point out some things, and that's why the handout. The handout is so that you have the fact points in front of you, so we can talk about it and get a little sense of what we're about to read about. We're about to read about seven bestowals. What's the big picture? What's the point of understanding all this detail? What's our relationship to all that detail? What's Michael's, or was Michael's relationship to all that detail? What's the main thing that's all about, that these bestowals are all about? So like we started stressing last week, when you look at even what they have in the preface here to this paper, they start getting you to try to recognize right away in the way they word what they say in the preface, that what he's up to. He starts out, he's created by the universal Father and the eternal Son in their image, i.e., the type of deity that he's made out of, because he's God, the type of deity that is personalized, the type of deity that he's made out of is some Father-type deity, downstepped from the infinite, some Son-type deity, downstepped from the infinite level, bonded together as one, and then personality grips it. Now, he's a Father-Son type being. Okay? And for all those a lot more than 199 billion all the time before that, too, but all that time, up to a billion years ago, that's still what he is. He has a number of experiences, but it's experiences of a Father-Son type deity being. And then he begins this process where he's going to go through these experiences, not so that he can get a divinity relationship to the Supreme. He's not going to make himself supremely divine on top of his existential nature and the experiences it's subsequently had. He's going to literally incorporate supreme type deity into his nature. How does he go about that? And how he goes about that is in a seven-step process. Let's look what's on this little handout I gave. So you've got the orders of the bestowals, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And we'll talk about all the details in a second. And as you notice, as you go through reading the bestowals, in each one they mention that he has has one or two attendants on that bestowal. Okay, and they're listed there. And then they mention that in each one of these bestowals, it's focused on a particular master spirit's nature. How he's going to acquire this, how he's going to synchronize himself with supreme type deity, and hence grab a hold of it himself, is via the sevenfold spirit of the master spirits. Altogether, they will allow him to synchronize with that measure of supreme type deity. And he's not going to do it all at once. He's going to do it one step at a time. Okay? Everyone that's read for a while remembers how the seven master spirits have one of each of the seven different combinations of relationship to the three absolute persons. And that's what's listed there. Okay, so before we go into the details, just notice a couple of big things that are in play here. Some of the details as he's step-by-step synchronizing himself with supreme-type deity. One of the things that should immediately catch your eye is those first four. He's a descending son, and so he's moving down with each bestowal. And those first four, as he moves down, the attendant is an angel that's moving up. You're moving up, see? If you go and look at the list of the angels, it's always Supernafim, number one, Sakonafim, number two, Sakon, second, number two, Tertiafim, three, okay, and Omniafim, four. You know, see, and they're in the reverse order. So as he goes down, the angel that's with him is of a higher and higher nature in stepwise fashion. So obviously there's some sort of coordination going on here. You know, what exactly is it? But, you know, even before you figure out what exactly is, it's obvious that there's some sort of complementary thing happening there so that they're always in balance as a pair. Okay? And then the other thing that catches your eye is that there's four of them where Gabriel is there. Well, what's up with that? Well, that, the thing that you should be suspicious of immediately if you glance over, you notice in 4, 5, and 6, the Father is not involved in that master spirit type. And, of course, you think about 7, yeah, that's the Father-like one. But, you know, as a babe in Bethlehem, is he connected yet? No. You know, he's born as just a helpless babe. He's not born some mature adult that can grab a hold of the Father and begin to express this. You know, he starts out as a single-celled organism in Mary's womb. Okay? So, in those four, either the whole time or for a part of the time, the Father likeness is, you know, off to the side. Gabriel has to be there for that. If Michael can't be directly part of the initiator connection, remember the Father is the initiator of a phenomenon. And so in those, that initiation can't just come right from the Father to Michael, because you know he's either setting that aside for a while, or you know, or for the whole bestowal. So Gabriel needs to be there to be part of that initiating the phenomenon. Okay. All right. So now let's go one step at a time, and let's start at the bottom where we are, so we can kind of appreciate it a little bit better. So 7, 6, 5, 4. Let's go in that order. Okay, so you know, you think about that first one, the father-like, where he's going to reveal father-like nature, or thinking about it from his perspective rather than what we would experience, he's going to synchronize with that facet of the Supreme that is just father-like, and it's related to Master Spirit number one. Okay. Well, from our perspective, that's where we start. We start at the bottom here, and sure enough, you know, if we're going to be really starting, the Father has to initiate that. So what's, you know, it's not any of the other ones. The initial one is the Father-like one, the initiator one. See, so what he's experiencing is what it's like to be a creature that's being initiated by the Father. During his 7th bestowal, even though he experiences that last, he's experiencing a creature in the initiation stage, where the Father is initiating that creature as a real phenomenon. So that's the Father-like one. You go to the next one. You go to the 6th bestowal. Okay, now, you know, we'll read this, but if you remember, he is a Morontia, ascending Morontia, son of the local universe, during that bestowal, an ascending sun. It's the sun-like bestowal. You know, so he's literally experiencing the father-like initiation in the 7th one. You know, he himself is experiencing what it's like to be an ascending sun. That's the sun-like one. Now, both of them, we need Gabriel, you know, but notice here in number 6, there's a seraphim also. Why? Okay, remember that section that's at the center of these 5 papers. You know, paper 117, section 6. And right in the middle of that, we read, the mother influence dominates the human personality throughout the local universe childhood of the growing soul. Okay. So if he's going to have a true experience of what it, you know, of a local universe ascending son, he has to have an experience where the mother influence dominates his personality throughout the entire bestowal. Okay. Well, he doesn't have mother likeness. Gabriel doesn't have mother likeness. You know, a seraphim is a child of the local universe mother spirit. Okay. And this is a single seraphim. So there's, it's only as a pair that they have any encirclement. It's just a single seraphim. So all you have is just what that seraphim is in and of herself. She has a mother-like nature that is part of this phenomenon. She's not just there, you know, to clean up his messes or something. I mean, she's a fundamental part of him being able to do this. Okay? She is supplying the mother nature to this complementary bestowal phenomenon. These attendants are essential. He can't do this without the attendant. Okay? That's why the attendant is there. So she's giving that mother-like influence that is circulating through his nature as he's having these experiences, and it's giving him a true facet of that sixth bestowal.
Did you say that the seraphim was a child of the local mother spirit?
Seraphim are children of the local universe, you know, mother spirit, creative mother spirit. You know, all these angels, remember, are children of, you know, someone in the infinite spirit, you know, realm. Seraphim are, you know, local angels.
The seraphim more or less take all the agencies that pour out upon us and kind of wrap them around and make them more personal for us.
Yeah, and see, so you're starting to get to this picture. See, in the seventh one, Gabriel has to be there because Michael can't do the initiating stuff. He has to be there so that this process, you know, no matter how mysterious and Sonarrington, you know, secret it is, you know, it has to be initiated. And so Gabriel's there, you know, even in thinking the details. I mean, you know, a mother and father had to be chosen and all that. You know, Gabriel was, you know, behind that whole getting that initiated, all the details and everything. So even in the, you know, very overt material things. Okay, you go to the next one. Again, Gabriel is fundamental to initiating the experiences he has there. He's not going to self-initiate those experiences. But he is a son, so that's within him. But then that son has to be immersed in a mother-like experience, like they just said, or it's not a true experience. And that's why the seraphim's there. Okay, so then the fifth one. Oh, yeah.
Would that be his first time experiencing the mother like that?
As we do, you know,
so
like that.
His first experience.
Yeah.
Well, the seraphim.
I mean, obviously, you know, he's been intimate with the creative mother spirit for a long time. He experiences like that, but that's as a creator.
Right.
You know, here he's experienced it as a creature, the way we will. Okay, then you go to the fifth bestowal. Okay, there he's on Universa as a spirit ascender. You know, he's literally a third stage spirit. It's kind of fun. It's even the third master spirit at that point. So he's a spirit ascender. So, I mean, just by his nature, again, what he is spirit-like. Hence, that's the spirit-like one. That's what he's going to be synchronizing with. Yeah. So that's why it's that particular master spirit that's, you know, in play here. And again, Gabriel was there to initiate it.
Were you referring to Gabriel as an ascender?
No. Jesus, you know, not Jesus, but Michael. In this case, you know, I call him Jesus, especially since he did it in the other order, you know. This is Michael is a spirit ascender. Gabriel is a stationary being. Okay, so the father-son spirits is this very, very literal. You know, what he is a creature at each of those points, and that's why he can synchronize with that.
So why is it technically creator can't experience the supreme like this as a creator, but only as a creature.
Fundamentally, the reason is, you know, you take all the personalities that are individuated by the Father, and there's two types. There's creator personalities and creature personalities. That's a fundamental. There aren't male personalities and female personalities, or, you know, seraphim personalities and human personalities and divine counselor personalities. I mean, there's just creator personalities and creature personalities. That's a very, very fundamental difference. And that's such a fundamental difference. That's the real deep mystery of the incarnation. How can a creator personality be a creature? You know, that's like saying, you know, how can a banana be a rutabaga? Okay? They're just very different. Okay? Okay.
Monsanto, any ideas?
This is, you know, when the revelators say, you know, we really, really struggle with how can this be? Recognize that's the real bottom line. Not all of the little details and stuff. That's the real bottom line. Because they know a creator son isn't just a fancier personality. It's a totally different type of personality. It's a type of personality that can engage deity. Not just a personality that can be divine, maybe massively divine, but still just divine. It engages deity. It's God. So how does that work?
But he can't engage the supreme type deity.
Right, because the supreme type deity is creature, creator, unifying deity. You know, that's what we're doing here. Creature and creator are unifying. He is acquiring a measure of supreme-like deity. Yeah. And it's a deep mystery how that occurs, but nonetheless it does.
Nobody ever, when they're at Sanarrington, there's only the creator sons there.
All the beings, you know, that are, that's the sun agent kind town. I mean, you can go there, but you can't go to the, you know, don't have access to the, you know, off limits areas. Just like every, you know, lots of beings can go to Ascendington, but they don't have access to the area that you have access to. The area that can only be understood by an ascender like you, and by understood, you mean literally. Those other beings have no relationship to that. And so it's like imagining you being taken to paradise right now. You'd have no experiences because you don't have any relationship to it yet.
Secret is safe.
You know, it's a secret because it's like this. You know, the things are here and you're here, and it doesn't matter how much you try to engage them, they don't meet. You cannot engage what's there.
Other beings were in Sanarrington at the place where they learn how to do the incarnation,
right.
They wouldn't get anything.
There's no way they can access that. It's completely transcendent. See, that's, so again, it's not just a matter of they're not allowed to read that book. Okay. See, it's literal.
It would be dangerous for a being to have that knowledge, because what could they do with it?
Right. I'm just trying to point out that's the way humans would tend to try to understand what's going on, but everything is literal in the universe. See? So I mean, if something is off limits, it's not because because it's dangerous. Because, you know, no one that's going to be going to Sanarrington is dangerous. You know, okay. You can't get there. Lucifer can't even remotely get there. I mean, that's clear off. You know, in paradise. Okay, remember, they don't even let you out of the local system if you're distinctly dangerous. I mean, you'll sit on Gerasim until, you know, you're stabilized enough that they'll let you out. I mean, as soon as Lucifer, you know, went off the edge, they put a wall, they sealed him in. He's not allowed to get out.
And the rebellion. It was all bubbled
up. Right. He can't even talk outside of the bubble, let alone go outside the bubble. He's absolutely cut off. You know, nothing that's that disconnected from reality is allowed out of a local system. Period.
Quarantine.
So it's not going to get all the way to Sanarrington. You know? So the point, see, is it has nothing to do with, you know, that would be dangerous or anything like that. Danger is no longer in play. The word danger doesn't have any meaning anymore there. You know, it's just a literal thing. There's literally no relationship to
that. You can't even make
that.
Contact with that stuff.
Right. Okay. So, okay, so now the fourth bestowal. Okay, so there he is attempting to synchronize with sun spirit-like nature. Okay, so for him to do that, he has to, you know, he has father-son-like innately. So if he's going to synchronize that, he's got to set the father-like nature aside. That can't be in play. If he brings that in play, there's no way he can synchronize with that facet. So his father-like nature is totally set off to the side in that bestowal. That's why Gabriel has to be there. Okay? Now, a little bit more about why does it have to be a Supernaphim? Besides the obvious thing that they're obviously some sort of a complementary, when he's small, they're big. You know, the angel's big. Remember, each one of these angels is a single angel, solitary, a lone angel, not a pair. With Supernaphim, if you have a pair of Supernaphim, then they're synchronized with the Father's circuits. Well, that'd mess this up. No Father in this one. You can't have a pair of Supernaphim. You can only have one. So that's fundamentally why you have one. Now, as a single Supernaphim, they are synchronized with the sun's circuits and the spirit's circuits. Well, that's no problem. That's what we're doing. Okay? See, so everything is compatible here. You go to the third one. Okay, there he's doing the Father's spirit-like synchronization. A Sakanaphim, a single Sakanaphim, is not only not connected to the Father, and it doesn't need to be because Michael's got the Father part. You know, what's he set aside to do this? He set his son likeness to the side now. The Father part, his Father part can be in play. But he set the son part aside. And the Sakanaphim, as a single one, also is not synchronized with the sun's circuits. So the Sakanaphim is not going to bring in the sun either as a single Sakanaphim. Okay? That's why, again, see why it's a Sakanaphim. But in both cases, both the Supernaphim and the Sakanaphim are the key to the spirit part of it. Michael doesn't have that. They're catalyzing his ability to do this. If he can't do spirit by himself. Without them, he can't do this. That's what I'm saying there. Attendant is a pretty mild word, you know. It's literally a complementary essential. This angel has to be there to help him synchronize with this facet
of
supremacy.
Is that? I mean,
yeah, what kind? See, just, you know, that's why I'm doing this right up front. I mean, you know, you read the stories and, you know, and you're just thinking, you know, two merry lads, you know, marching along on some world having some bestowal experience. It's much more profound than that. We're talking about a bestowal thing where there is some sort of deeply transcendent overlapping of natures. I mean, he and this angel are merged in some way temporarily, you know, and creating a super additive consequence that he's latching onto.
Do they just have to be on the same world, or do they have to actually be local to it?
Right, you can imagine. See, that's what all the revelators are. It's like, well, how exactly does that work? Do you know, when they're too far away, does it, you know, break the connection? I mean, you know, but it's very literal. See, everything is literal. You know, if you know that if they're there, it's essential to this thing in some way. It's not just for convenience.
Chris, yep. I noticed I circled each one with its own color and found the Father, Son, and Spirit had four matches for each one. So I was wondering if there was a connection with the four Gabriels and the four other connections, or the third Gabriel connections.
Right, I mean, you can see there's all kinds of patterns to this, yeah. You know. And when you create the seven different of the three, you know, and how this obviously kind of splits, you know, it's two sets of four that are overlapping there in the on the fourth one. And, you know, there's a number of interesting patterns here that are giving you clues about the nature of this synchronizing with the Supreme. And just, you know, the order, you know, that it goes 7, 4, 5, 6, 3, 2, 1, you know, why isn't it, you know, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1? You know, see, there's clues. See, there's some sort of physics going on here about how he achieves this. There's a certain order it has to happen in. And okay, all we're trying to do is just kind of begin to look into that a little bit by just noticing some of the obvious things here. You go to the second bestowal. Okay, now he has father son like. Okay, so that one's going to be pretty immediate for him. Why is it a tershifim? Now a tershifim, as a single one, is not synchronizing with the Father, the Son, or the Spirit circuits. So that's helpful. It's not bringing in the Spirit, like the Sakanafim or the Sapernafim would have. So that's why they couldn't be there. But a tershifim is going to... And the tershifim are children of the Infinite Spirit. Those angels, that type of angel, is a child of the Infinite Spirit, who makes tershifim specifically to synchronize with Creator Sons. Remember, it was 1,000 tershifim that came out with Michael when he came out to set up the local universe, because they're designed to synchronize with him in his initial existential state, his father-son-like state. See, this is the perfect angel for that, to amp it up so that it's not just what he has as a father-son existentially, but that angel is going to help him to get the father-son-like part of the experiential, that's part of supremacy. Okay?
So like number six, son, spirit-like, so we've got the fathers, which would be Gabriel, so... What would the
Sapernafim
be?
Spirit. I mean, remember, they're all children of the Spirit. They all, just by their nature, what they are, could be Spirit. But we're talking about more than that. We're talking about being able to synchronize. And they can synchronize with the Spirit's circuits. The Sapernafim and the Sakanafim. The Tershifim may have been created by the Infinite Spirit, but as a single one, he doesn't synchronize with the circuits of the Spirit. So that energy is not flowing through this combination.
You said they synchronize with who?
As a single one, none. A Tershifim by itself is none.
But if there was two?
If there was two... then they bring these circuits into play. I mean, if you have two of them, they can synchronize with the circuits. With Sakanafim and Sapernafim, even a single one can synchronize with some. The Sakanafim can synchronize with the Spirit's circuits just as a single one. The Sapernafim can synchronize with the Spirit and the Son's circuits just as a single one. But to synchronize with the Father, you need two of them.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think I would get a bigger picture of this. If you would tell me what Michael bestowed himself as on each.
Yeah, we want to really get to that. I mean, it's not going to really add anything to it right now. I mean, the whole point is just to recognize what's going on behind the scenes. We'll get into the details of who he was, you know, like a Melchizedek and a Lenonendek, a material son. But that's not telling us anything about this, you know, in any immediate way that we can recognize. I'm sure it's very related, but it's not as immediately obvious as what's going on here.
Just give me a bigger picture.
Okay. You know, so we'll do that. See, we're going to add that. The point was not to do everything here, just to give you this, because this is not what's immediately apparent when you read the stories. Who he is immediately apparent. We can talk about that when we read the specific stories.
We've got number six, son, spirit-like, and then Sapernafim, and then Gabriel. So I understand that Gabriel is the father part. The Sapernafim, then...
Spirit.
They're the spirit, but he's already got son, spirit, so he's already being a spirit.
No, he can't be a spirit. All he has is father and son.
Okay. on number six?
Right. Yeah. What is a creator son made out of? Is he made out of spirit-like stuff? No, he's made out of father-like stuff and son-like stuff, and that's all he's made out of.
Okay.
Okay? So he can do the son-like part of this son spirit, but he can't do the spirit-like part. And, of course, he's got to set his father-like part to the side, or that's going to mess it up. If he brings his father-like part into play, he's not going to synchronize with son spirit. He's got to set the father-like stuff aside.
Son, and they're not separate, son spirit. His spirit is from this firmament. He's not being the son spirit.
The energy.
Yes, he's going to be, but he's not that by nature. He's trying to add that to him. He doesn't have son spirit by nature, by birth. He's trying to add that to what he is. All he had by birth was father, son. And all these other ones he's trying to add. And even on the father-son-like one, and the second bestowal, he's trying to add experiential father-son-likeness to his existential father-son-likeness. Every one of these is experiential deity that he's adding. All seven of them. He's not, and the seventh bestowal, he's not adding existential father-likeness. He already had that. Okay. He's adding experiential father-likeness. Because it's all about bringing in the supreme type deity, which is experiential deity. Right, he's. Yeah, he has existential sun-like nature. He's trying to add just experiential sun-like nature. And they gave us a clue in paper 117 that to have a sun-like experiential experience, experiential deity experience, however the heck you want to say that, it has to be in wombed. There has to be mother likeness there. So he has to have that seraphim there. See, one of these seven requires direct mother like encirclement in the phenomenon. You remember the eternal son has, we call him the eternal mother spirit for a reason. There's a linkage to the mother there. And that's the son like one. Okay, so the tertiafim because it's designed to match the father-son-like. Okay, now, why the omniafim in the first one? Okay, now see, this is the one, our master spirit, is father-son-spirit-like. And remember, this is a facet of supremacy. This is not the Trinity. But immediately you should go, I never thought about that. Supernafim, Sakonafim, Tertiafim is obviously 1, 2, 3. But it always, it's kind of curious. It goes 1, 2, 3, all. You just say the prefixes. All what? Omni means all. Oh, all three.
Yeah.
Okay. And if you go back, and then you go back and look about where the omnifim come from, and it's like, no wonder. I just didn't put it two and two together. Okay, where do omnifim come from? Omnifim are the joint offspring of the infinite spirit and the supreme executives. Okay? The supreme executives. Okay, and then you go and look, where does this supreme executives come from? Remember, there's seven supreme executives, one for each of the seven super universes. Where do those supreme executives come from? It says that they are trinitized by the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. Not created. They're not created by the Father, Son, and Spirit. They're trinitized by the Father, Son, and Spirit. Okay. The omnifim are a type of angel that are very definitively related to the Trinity of Supremacy. which is what, you know, we're about here, see, in this first bestowal. Now, that father-son likeness, that's the Trinity of supremacy. And he's, so he needs, see, I mean, he has father-son, he doesn't have spirit, but the whole point, you know, what we're trying to do here is the three together, where he's trying to synchronize with the, you know, with the full Trinity of supremacy in this first one. And he certainly can't do that by himself. This Omni of Him is all important, see? The Omni of Him has that by nature. So when he immerses himself in the energy of that Omni of Him, he has access to this. And what the Omni of Him just has in divinity, he acquires in deity.
Circuit.
Yeah, it's like they're in circuited, see, together. And together when they're together, he can grab a hold of that facet of the supreme type deity.
So whoever is the attendant must be coming away from the experience of something superadded also.
Yeah, and see, that's completely unspoken, but you know, as soon as you read it, it's like, wow, what is it like to have been an angel involved in one of these things?
Right.
Oh my goodness. I mean, this is going to be very similar to what's it like to be a thought adjuster to a creator son.
Friends for life.
I mean, there's going to be some sort of eternal synchronization between these angels.
See, that's the thing.
And Michael. See, and it's very easy to discover this. I mean, all you have to do is just take the facts, write them down, and start, it's like, okay, well, wait a minute, I noticed something here. And start, you know, following where the facts lead you, you know. I mean, you hardly have to have any truth going at all. This is kind of just following some facts, and you're discovering some more facts. But let the truth be in there, too. I mean, see, there's a great truth to what's going on in these bestowals. This is so not just little stories. There's something really profound. They're bestowals. They're one of the secrets. It's one of the most transcendent things that happens in all of infinity and eternity. It's what we're reading about. Any glimpse of what's actually going on should be just infinitely intriguing to us. And that's what I'm trying to get you to see here. So you don't think of these just simple little stories. Something really amazing going on here. Okay? All together with these seven, he's got this complex encirclement that allows him to actually take the supreme type deity and stick it on. So it's Father, Son, Supreme. And he's not a creator son anymore. He's a master son.
How does it relate to the pattern that we also go through with the psychic circles? We grow back in balance. And if you don't, you really don't make the circles. You don't.
Yeah, that's one of going to be the big things. You know, the biggest answer to the question you brought up is in the last section of this paper. After we've done with the bestowals and we really kind of appreciate, okay, he's done the supreme-like thing, then the last section is where it really brings it home. What's the relationship between what Creator Son's experience and what we experience? Because we've been told many times that there's a parallel. We're gonna bring that in. We know that the mother comes in here, and we know we're in parallel to the Creator Son, so we should be able to think about all this now. Our relationship to the Supreme compared to his relationship to the Supreme. Our relationship to the Father compared to his relationship to the Father. Our relationship to the Mother compared to his relationship to the Mother. We should be able to put all of that together, and that's what we're going to do in the last section, so that you can really see why this is fundamentally one of the five papers. Because the more you understand about his relationship to these things, the more you understand your relationship. That's what they're trying to get at. Remember, this is revelation is for us. This has to have direct importance to us. You know, not just historical curiosity. Oh, I know a little bit about a story that happened a billion years ago. That can't be what it's about. There has to be something literally related to you, or it wouldn't be in the book. You know, this is about your ascension scheme. This book is about your ascension. Everything in here is literally tied to you in some way, and is relevant to you in a more than an intellectual curiosity way. That's what we're seeking, you know, to begin to answer that question. Whatever we're reading, whether we're reading about paleontology or we're reading about the bestowals, whatever we're reading about, I want to know literally, how does this relate to the fact that I'm a cosmic citizen? That I'm more than just a child of God. Okay, so that, just picking up on that little passing thing, you know, that each one of them, they say, and he mysteriously showed up in the company of a lone Supernovant or whatever, you know, asking, why? Why did he show up in the company of a lone Supernovant? Don't just take that for granted. Ask yourself why, you know, and don't let go until you figure it out.
Yeah, not just a flourish.
All right, so let's do the first bestowal.
The first bestowal. It was a solemn occasion on Salvington almost 1 billion years ago when the assembled directors and chiefs of the universe of Nebadon heard Michael announce that his elder brother Emmanuel would presently assume authority in Nebadon while he, Michael, would be absent on an unexplained mission. No other announcement was made about this transaction except that the farewell broadcast to the Constellation Fathers, among other instructions, said, quote, "And for this period I place you under the care and keeping of Emmanuel, while I go to do the bidding of my paradise father." End quote.
Everything is really straightforward there. And everyone really remembers how often when they refer to Emmanuel, he's referred to as an elder brother. Have you ever asked yourself why? Why is he called an elder brother? I mean, am I supposed to think it's like, you know, he's actually, they're twins and he was born 5 minutes before? I mean, elder in what sense? Okay. Well, you know that what this is all about is growing relationship to the Supreme. Emmanuel is a union of days. A union of days is what type of being? He's a Supreme Trinity personality. A Supreme Trinity personality. He's elder in the supremacy sense. See? He is more mature relative to the Supreme by nature, because he's created a Supreme Trinity personality. Michael is not as mature. He's not mature at all, to start with, till a billion years ago, when he started to mature relative to, you know, to the Supreme. And so, see, it's in that context. He's the elder. He has more of a relationship to experiential deity than Michael does. I mean, obviously, they're both, you know, have a lot of ties to existential. The Union of Days is not deity, but he's, you know, pretty high divine fact, and it's Trinity, and, there's a lot of stuff, a lot of connection to paradise there and existential deity. He's elder. Despite the fact that he's not God, he's not a creator, he's still called elder. You know, why? Because he's more mature relative to the Supreme.
I always thought he was deity.
Now, the Ancients of Days are God, mm-hmm. but not the rest of them.
Okay.
Not even the Eternals of Days. They're just divine. So only the Ancients of Days are in God the Sevenfold.
Okay.
Yeah. They're different. They're God.
No, wait a minute. You were saying divine.
Yeah.
Also deity or just divine?
A union of days is just divine. It's not personalized deity, it's just a divine personality. And a very high one. A supreme Trinity personality. Pretty high being, but not deity. Not personalized deity, not God.
But then you said he was a part of the sevenfold.
The Ancients of Days are part of God the Sevenfold. They're God. But see, remember, there's the Eternals of Days, the Ancients of Days, you know, et cetera, you know, all those of days.
But you just said Emmanuel is an Ancient of Days.
No, he's a Union of Days. Oh. A Union of Days, yeah.
Man, and, one Union of Days?
Yeah, there's 700,000 of them. There's one for each local universe.
Oh, so Emmanuel
is our local universe's Union of Days, yeah.
Every Michael has an older brother.
Yeah, yeah, and see that, and remember that's why they're called Union, because you know when the Creator Son and the Union of Days see are there on the local universe headquarters together, what's occurring? The dual domain of the local universe and the triune domain of the super universe meet at that point. There's a union of the two at that point. That's why they're called Unions of Days.
Also, but you know, in that distinction you were making about divine
and deity, yeah.
Deity.
Yeah.
Michael is God.
Right.
So in that respect, he's elder.
Right. But see, so and that's why I'm saying it's like, well, wouldn't he be elder because he's creator? See, that's what I'm saying. It's like, why are they calling him elder?
But again, like he's
experiencing wisdom, he's elder.
Right. See, Emmanuel plays a really critical role in this whole bestowal phenomenon. Emmanuel takes over for Michael while he's doing these bestowals. Why can he do that? Because he's an elder. There needs to be someone who, if he's not going to have a creator nature like the Creator Son does, he needs to have a supreme nature like he does, in order to take over for a Creator Son.
He has to be able to do the job.
Yeah. See, so he's elder, you know, in this regard, this experiential regard.
Comment that they make about if a rebellion were to occur during a bestowal, his role is different.
Mm-hmm. See, yeah, we take care of that by fiat.
We're done.
Yeah. All right.
Emmanuel?
Yeah. You know, he could just take care of it. Because he already has the supreme, you know, relationship to be able to do that. Until Michael had that relationship to supremacy, he couldn't do it. He couldn't solve it by fiat like that. It had to work out, you know, however it worked out. Okay. But then he has supreme sovereignty. So, see, he's elder. He has supreme sovereignty. He can, you know, he can function as a supreme sovereign while Michael is in a bestowal.
So are you saying there won't be any more rebellions now that he's sovereign?
Michael can deal with it now. Yeah, I remember it makes a comment about that. I mean, it's a little hard to know how to answer that question because, obviously the potential is still there, but my guess is it probably won't actualize. I think the local universe has gotten that out of its system. Remember out of its three systems technically, remember what they said about, you know, what happened in the third rebellion here, you know, in our local system. One lowly being on this planet really changed everyone's recognition, not just in the local universe but the whole super universe. What of Amadon? Remember, Amadon really drove the point home. I don't think anyone is ever going to not get it now. You know, that was kind of the point they made. Amadon sort of penetrated. What Amadon did is that lowly, you know, primitive mortal, yeah, upstepped, but still pretty primitive in the grand scheme of things. What he did in the face of that rebellion cut through all of the confusion of the lesser beings in the local universe. The Lindon Index, it got through their noggins, okay? I don't think it's going to happen again. But if it did, they say, you know, I mean, Michael could deal with it summarily if he chose now. Yeah.
But he being a mercy.
Right, right,
creator,
so. Right. If you go back and read that, you see how they point out. It's like, well, you know what? I don't think he would handle it any different than he did before, you know. But see, just, you know, recognize that it's probably a moot point now.
Non-index are forever changed.
I think it's clear now. Lowly Amadon just trumped that Lenon and Deck that used to be a system sovereign. That was a pretty harsh lesson for the other Lenonidex, you know, that they maybe shouldn't get a fat head.
Plus, isn't there a
put it in simple terms. Okay?
Plus, isn't there a special commission or whatever it is?
Yeah, and you've got a college now. College. There's a Melchizedek set up. Remember, that's why it's called Norlacia Dec, why they stuck a double suffix on that. Why isn't this Norlacia? You know, why did they stick a Dec suffix on there so that it's tied to, you know, the other use of that, like Melchizedek? Because the Melchizedek set up two special colleges in this constellation. You know, the deal, you know, related to the rebellion, one related to the rebellion, and one related to the fact that this was Michael's Vestol constellation.
Can we go to that college if we want?
Yeah, we can go, yeah.
I want to go to
after right. Sending this farewell broadcast, Michael appeared on the dispatching field of Salvington, just as on many previous occasions when preparing for departure to Uversa or Paradise, except that he came alone. He concluded his statement of departure with these words, "I leave you but for a short season. Many of you, I know, would go with me, but whither I go, you cannot come. That which I am about to do, you cannot do. I go to do the will of the Paradise deities. And when I am finished my mission and have acquired this experience, I will return to my place among you." And having thus spoken, Michael of Nebadon vanished from the sight of all those assembled and did not reappear for 20 years of standard time in all Salvington. Only the divine minister and Emmanuel knew what was taking place. And the Union of Days shared his secret only with the chief executive of the universe, Gabriel, the bright morning star.
Okay. Couple little details. Notice little details. The one is just a factual point. If you can't remember, 20 years of standard time, we're talking about local universe standard time. It's about 5 years per local universe year, so that's about 100 years in Urantia years, which they say in just a little bit, but just so you know that right now. But the other thing is related to what we're just, you know, kind of going through with this, okay? Notice how he says it. He doesn't say, "That which I'm about to do, you're not allowed to do." He doesn't say that. It's not that you're not allowed, is that you cannot do it. This is not a matter of, you know, you could hold on to the basket, you know, and I'll finally give in. You cannot do what's about to happen. This is a literal physics issue, okay? There's only one type, an omniophim, you know, is the only one that can do this. Not even Gabriel. Gabriel's not only an omniphim can go with him on this. And just one. If there was two of them, there'd be encirclement, you know, and that would mess it up. Okay? One omniphim can do it and no one else. So again, see, it's just the literal, there's always something literal going on if there is a you know, a sign up that says, you know, do not pass this point. I mean, it's not arbitrary. And always see if you can figure out what the literal thing is. Because if you can, then you'll begin to really get going with the flow of the revelation.
What happens to the omniophims? Because they are their
own. Yeah, there's another mysterious question that we don't have an answer to. Aren't we sure what happens to the omniphim itself, or Earth, but what's it, you know, can that omniophim pair up like they used to? Or now can they only pair up with other ones that have, I mean, I don't know. you know, maybe they can still pair up, but now when they pair up, there's something going on that wasn't, you know, maybe there is some sort of relationship to the Supreme that there didn't used to be. Or see, you can start speculating. I don't know.
They're a class.
They're a, yeah.
How do we know it was only?
Oh, because they say.
It says they're in the next period.
Yeah, we haven't gotten there yet.
What strikes me more than anything else is, while we're immensely curious, mm-hmm. the statement that he makes
yeah.
has no regard for, anybody, curiosity.
I know. Zero. I know. That's one of the funny subtexts of these stories, yeah.
Okay, see you. Bye.
Yep. And it's, you know, it's just as funny on the flip side when he gets back to, you know, get to
I
the
like
end.
I love the language, like, wither.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, we're paralleling the Bible here, obviously, you know. But yeah, well, whither you go, you know.
The other possible clue is the word experience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
right.
I'm sure he had experience going to paradise and Uversa and other tasks that he did. But that might be a clue that he was going to go acquire the Father's experience, i.e. bestowal.
Yeah, and
subtext.
Well, in this one, it's the Father, Son, Spirit. But but again, notice carefully the words. Yeah, very good point. I mean, it's experience because we're engaging experiential deity, trying to synchronize with experiential deity. But notice it doesn't say, that he's just going to have an experience. The word is acquired. Like I said, he's literally going to, you know, incorporate this into his being, acquire it. Okay, very literal again. They're always very careful with words like that.
Will of paradise deities? Which deities? Like which?
Well, this first one, it's Father, Son, Spirit.
After that, okay.
Yeah.
Father, Son, Spirit.
The time he's doing the
seventh collective
stole,
one.
He acquired all of this other part of the list.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, he's doing it all in what kind of seems like a reverse order. Which, see, is interesting in itself that, I mean, just mention that. I you just made me think of one thing I wanted to mention. You know, why is this one first? Why is the Father, Son, Spirit-like one first? I mean, you can answer that question. You maybe can't answer why they're in all the rest of them are in the order they are, but you can definitely answer why that one's first, because, like I said, the whole point is to synchronize with the Trinity of Supremacy. You have to initiate that phenomenon literally with the Trinity of Supremacy, you know, bestowal, so that's the context. And then within that context, these other things are part of the supreme thing and not separate. You have to start by sort of creating the place. And then within that place, you know, you're going to bring in these other facets. And those facets are going to then, you know, it's going to be Father, Son likeness relative to the supreme and not, you know, just relative to the Father and the Son.
Didn't you say that was our master spirit as well?
Yeah.
So in the sixth super universe, it would initiate from a different point of view?
No, I mean, it's always, every creator son, and no matter what super universe they are, has to start like this. But there is some special things about that. Remember when, no matter what super universe you come from, you get to Havona, you get to the sixth circuit of Havona, and you need some help synchronizing with the Trinity of Supremacy. That's what you're trying to do on the sixth circuit of Avona. The seventh master spirit helps everyone from every super universe on the sixth circuit of Avona, because, see, he has that nature. It's not the first master spirit can't deal with that.
Chris,
yep.
So the salving time, then, this is where he's taking off from salving.
Right.
Salvington is saving kind place.
Saved kind town. Mm-hmm.
So, and then, okay, so he's on, but this is the only place where he starts. The rest
that's
of the place
that's
is
his home.
That's because it's his hometown. Yeah, that's where he lives.
What about Sanarrington? I thought they lived on Sanarrington.
That's paradise.
No, he's a creator son. He's out here. I mean, that's a, you know, a paradise home base. Just like Ascendington is going to be your paradise home base, but you know you're not going to be living on Ascendington. You're going to be out in the seven super universes doing stuff as a finaliter. You know, it's just if you go back, that's it's your home base. And I don't know other way to say it. I mean, that's why they use the T-O-N suffix. It's literally because that's the easiest way to understand your relationship. It's your hometown. T-O-N means town. I mean, it's your hometown. You only use that T-O-N suffix for a place name if it's in some way a hometown. I mean, it's Salvington because it will forever be, you know, your hometown town of remembrance when you actually were fully saved when all of yourself had no scaffolding under it anymore. It was totally infused in spirit. That which is spiritized is saved. You know, you go back there to, you know, everyone goes back for a reunion. And what are you reminiscing about? You're reminiscing about, remember when we all were finally literally saved, when we became first stage spirits? You know, that's the kind of hometown reunion you're having there. You go back to Ascendington, okay, what kind of a hometown, you know, you're not remembering about when you're saved, you're remembering about when you came a finaliter, you know. You completed your ascension.
And then the final question I have now, who's the divine minister?
Creative Mother Spirit.
Oh.
Yeah.
Isn't she like the grandmother? I mean, yeah, isn't she the wife?
Yeah, she's a
wife.
She's never done. Quote, unquote. Yeah.
But not of the local.
Yeah.
Oh, she
She's the local universe. Mother Spirit, the divine who minister.
Said, let the rebellion take
place. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. This is a totally local thing. I mean, this is just, you know, he and she, and then there's Emmanuel, and then Gabriel. I mean, you know, he's brought in. It's just, this is just a local thing happening.
They should just stick with one name for everyone.
Yeah, yeah. But they don't, and see, and you know, and we don't do it all the time, but you can always do that. You can always, why did they use divine minister here instead of creative mother spirit? I mean, you can always, you know, and I don't want to go into that every time, but you can always spend some time reflecting on that yourself. It's not random. Yeah, if they say divine minister, they've got some reason for that. It's something about it, you know?
It's describing their duties or what they were doing at the time.
Yeah, there's something, see, about the relationship, and yeah.
Chris, speaking of mm-hmm. things being called different things,
mm-hmm.
I thought that the Morning Star was Lucifer.
Oh, well, see, right, see, that's an example, you know, Venus rising is the bright morning star. I mean, and, you know, in Latin, the Venus rising was called Lucifer. You know, and way down the road, you know, that became used as a name for a being, you know, used for another name for the devil. And, you know, but of course, it's really just a name for Venus, you know, in the morning. And you know, why do they, you know, see, there's all these questions like this. Why did they take the term bright morning star and tie it to Gabriel? You know, why did they call that kind of being bright morning stars in our local one, Gabriel? Well, if you look in the book of Revelation and you look at how they refer to bright morning star in there, you'll go, oh, I see why they chose that, because of the relationship between what, you know, between, you know, this whole notion of archangels and whatnot. And, you know, if you look in Revelation, you'll see, remember what they're told to do. They're told, if humans have some proper designation, it doesn't even have to be an actual sort of name-like name. It can be a phrase, like bright morning star. If they have some phrase like that, like Ancient of Days, if they have some phrase that you recognize, you know, you revelators recognize could be very appropriately applied to some being, you have to do that rather than coining a new designation. And so they searched everything that humans have written, you know, and they look at all the times that humans refer to bright morning star. And the first thing they noticed is, okay, it isn't utterly corrupted in its references, so it's a possibility for use. And then they said, and of the way it's used, you know, that really works well. The way they use it there, that we could grab a hold of that and encourage an evolutional relationship to that human usage. It's like they're saying, you know how you use that? Kind of take just the basic spirit of the notion behind your usage there. That's what we're playing off of. You know, now give it a solid true thing. That's what they're always doing. Again, you know, why do they call the one Lucifer that they call Lucifer and the one they call Satan that they call Satan? I mean, it's not random. They, you know, you look at how humans have used the designation Lucifer, and the more you study it, the more you realize, oh, it's much more apropos to use that for the actual system sovereign than for his deputy. And it's much more apropos to use the designation Satan for his deputy than for the, you know, et cetera. And why didn't they use either of them for the planetary rebel planetary prince? Because it wasn't as apropos in terms of what how humans have used that designation or what the word means literally. It's that's what they're always doing. You know, they're trying to take what we've got and use it as best they can. They said they can use it even if there is a potential for more distortion of meaning in play. You have to use it. That was their revelatory mandate. It's only if it was, if its use would be an utter corruption of the truth that the revelatory mandate said, okay, you know, you don't have to use that. You can coin a new term. Okay.
They almost didn't use love.
Right, yeah, right, because we have that word so corrupted. Yeah. So, you know, it just, you know, they used every, you know, everyone they could find that was, you know, reasonably appropriate.
The Midwayers have followed the etymology of actual language on the planet of Urantia all the way through.
Right. There's just an endless thing that you could study relative to this. I mean, the more you know about the human usage, or even, you know, going back before it was actually that English term, you know, follow it back into other languages and whatnot. I mean, the more you do that, the more you're going to appreciate why they made these choices the way they did. They're very, very masterful at this.
Yeah.
You know, what little I've done, I'm just endlessly impressed by it.
Calogastus is not mentioned in the Bible.
No, of course not, because they had a coin of word. You know, they only had two proper names, and they needed three. Well, actually, they needed four. They needed Dalagastia too. You know, so they coined a word. You know, and it just literally means, you know, the entity that is entirely darkness, Calogastia. Yeah.
I often wondered if referring to Gabriel as the bright morning star, there's another being called Evening Star.
Brilliant Evening Stars. That's, you know, there's a Brilliant Evening Star that's writing this paper, Gavali.
Somehow assumed that because he was evening, he came after.
Again, see, you know, where do bright and morning star and brilliant evening star, those two terms, that refers to Venus, you know, in the morning and Venus in the evening, you know. You know, you have Lucifer and Vesper, for instance, you know, and that's why you have evening Vespers. Because, I mean, that's the god name for, you know, they thought Venus was a god, and they didn't realize that the Venus in the morning was the same as the Venus in the evening. They were both Venus. They thought they were two different things, and so there's, all the ancients always had two different names. For you know, whether or not Venus is close to the sun, you know, around dawn or around sunset, and so it's, but the reason again that they that seems like, well, they actually used a silly notion like that. Well, it's because if you look at how you know, it's gone beyond that sort of simplistic usage. It's been used in, you know, in a more generalized, enlightened sense. Like I said, when you're reading it in Revelation, the book of Revelation is not talking about Venus, okay, but it's using that term. And it's using it in a particular context, a context that's very apropos to Gabriel, okay? If you were to tell the story in more accurate, you know, with a more accurate understanding of how the universe works, rather than that confused, childish, you know, story in the book of Revelation. You go, the person that's doing this role, I know the name of that person. That name is, person is Gabriel. Gabriel's working with Michael, and, you know, that's why they're using it that way. All right.
Okay. All the inhabitants of Salvington and those dwelling on the constellation and system headquarters worlds assembled about their respective receiving stations for universe intelligence, hoping to get some word of the mission and whereabouts of the Creator Son. Not until the third day after Michael's departure was any message of possible significance received. On this day, a communication was registered on Salvington from the Melchizedek sphere, the headquarters of that order in Nebadon, which simply recorded this extraordinary and never before heard of transaction. At noon today, there appeared on the receiving field of this world, a strange Melchizedek son, not of our number, that holy, but wholly like our order. He was accompanied by a solitary omniophim, who bore credentials from Uversa and presented orders addressed to our chief, derived from the Ancients of Days and concurred in by Emmanuel of Salvington, directing that this new Melchizedek son be received into our order and assigned to the emergency service of the Melchizedeks of Nebadon. And it has so been ordered. It has so been done.
Okay, just a couple things in there. Remember why the Ancients of Days, they mentioned that in the preface. Again, they're Supreme Trinity personality. So they have a lot of relationship to this whole supreme phenomenon that we got going here, this attempt to synchronize with the supreme. And remember, they're the final arbiters of whether or not this is done. And it needs to be them, because we're not talking about just synchronizing with the supreme in terms of divinity, but in terms of deity. And of all this, all these Supreme Trinity personalities, all the of days, only one of them is God, the Ancients of Days. And that's why they're the arbiter of this supreme deity synchronization. Yeah, that's why they're involved. Remember, that's just, I just wanted to, you know, tie you back to what we read last week. See, and here's, so, oh, she's gone. I mean, anyway, here's the solid, the fact that it's solitary, omnifim. And, you know, everyone was chuckling, you know, because, you know, you got to love the little kid, like, you know, they're all huddled around their radios, you know, you know, listening for news from the home front or whatever, you know.
Crackling speaker trying to
host this. Yeah, I know. Everything, you know, obviously, there's, you know, everything ground to a halt, you know. Yeah, it's just really funny, all the little details like that. But for those of you who can't remember what's going on here. He didn't go far. Well, apparently. I mean, who knows where he actually went. But in terms of from point A to point B, to, you know, he's on Salvington, and then you've got the 70... you know, worlds around Salvington broken up into groups of seven, you know, 10 groups of seven, you know, and there's the seven that are the Melchizedek worlds. I mean, he's just going, you know, like this.
Next door.
But what happened in between, you know, no one knows. It's part of the secret of Sennarington. But you know, he ends up just right there.
Yeah. I just had a question. It probably doesn't matter, but why does he arrive at noon a lot?
Oh, that's yeah. I mean, there's a lot. I mean, they explain that. I mean, there's noon and midnight are important relative to communication and transportation. I mean, there's physics to this. See, and they're literally, you know, there are times when you can't do it unless you've gotten the sun of that world, you know, whatever. I mean, completely, you know, to the opposite. So it's not, it's interfering with what you're doing as little as possible. You know, if you read all the stuff about transport angels, you know, and communications and stuff, you'll notice noon and midnight. It's the physics of the situation. You know, and obviously I can't explain to you exactly, but it's very obvious when you study it that it's something to do with the physics of it. It optimizes the, you know, the connectivity. See, again, it's another clue. You know, there's going to be some detail there. If you want to learn more about fundamental physics, that would actually be some clue. You know, you wouldn't think to turn to a story about angels, you know, to try to figure out your fundamental physics. But it's, you know, it's right there. There's something very key about sub-electronic level physics and stuff going on there, and I don't know what it is.
Which makes some sense if you're just arriving. But when he arrived on this planet, it was after 9 months, and he still was born at noon.
Yeah. It's time, Mom! It's noon! Come
yeah.
on!
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course, it would be
come on, Mary.
Modern daylight savings time. It would be one.
And he was born on Sunday. You know, and John the Baptist was born on New Year's Day, you know. March 25th was New Year's Day back then. You know, it was you know, the vernal equinox. I mean, there's all these mysterious temporal coincidences, yeah, that Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, let's move on.
Okay.
This is about all that appears on the records of Salvington regarding the first Michael Bestowal. Okay, we're done. Nothing more appears until after 100 years of Urantia time, where there was recorded the fact of Michael's return and unannounced resumption of the direction of universe affairs. But a strange record is to be found on the Melchizedek worlds, a recital of the service of this unique Melchizedek son of the emergency corps of that age. This record is preserved in a simple temple, which now occupies the foreground of the home of the Father Melchizedek, and it comprises the narration of the service of this transitory Melchizedek son in connection with his assignment to 24 missions of universe emergency. And this record, which I have so recently reviewed, ends thus.
You can free read that, just one little comment, because we'll lose sight of it. You know, the other side here, you know, is even more hilarious when you think about it. The fact of Michael's return and unannounced resumption of the direction. I mean, he just appeared one day and just went right back to his duties like nothing happened, didn't explain anything to anyone, just completely ignored it. Yeah, and everyone's going, what
is it? He's back.
Not a word, just goes right back. So, all right, so this is the record that he recently read here.
And at noon on this day, without previous announcement, and witnessed only by three of our brotherhood, this visiting son of our order disappeared from our world as he came, accompanied only by a solitary omni of him. And this record is now closed with the certification that this visitor lived as a Melchizedek in the likeness of a Melchizedek. He worked as a Melchizedek, and he faithfully performed all of his assignments as an emergency son of our order. By universal consent, he has become chief of Melchizedeks, having earned our love and adoration by his matchless wisdom, supreme love, and supreme devotion to duty.
Superb.
And his superb devotion to duty. He loved us, understood us, and served with us. And forever we are his loyal and devoted fellow Melchizedeks. For this stranger on our world has now eternally become a universe minister of Melchizedek nature.
Okay. And here's a great example of two things, actually. This record, which I have so recently reviewed, ends thus. Okay, and then you read this and you go, wait a minute, that's almost some direct quotes from the book of Hebrews there. Hmm. Okay, yeah, remember how this is done. I mean, you know, they're taking whatever that record, you know, actually said, and they're giving you an English expression of it. And part of the revelatory mandate is, if you can find something that's said in human, you know, in a human work that appropriately expresses what you have to express, you need to say it that way. You know, you can't, not only can't you coin a word if you don't have to, you can't, you know, compose sentences if you don't have to. You have to make this book as evolutional as possible. You have to use as much human stuff as possible, you know, in writing the book, so that it's as immediately approachable to humans as possible. You know, don't write it as an archangel, because you're not very similar to a human, and it's just going to come off as written by some Kuzbanian. Okay, they're not going to relate to it. Okay, they need to be able to relate to it. So you've got to use human expression. So there's that, but then on top of it, it's just, you know, if you flip it around, it's really fascinating. I mean, you know, you've got, I don't know how familiar you all are with what goes on in what is that, like chapters 5, 6, and 7 or so, you know, in the early chapters of Hebrews, when they're talking about a priest forever of the order of Melchizedek and all that stuff, you know, in the book of Hebrews, you know, neither mother nor father and all those things that are in Hebrews about Melchizedek. It's really remarkable because all you have in the Bible is that one little passage in Genesis and that one little passage in Psalms. And then you have all this stuff in Hebrews, which they're pointing out is amazingly usable. Okay? They're saying, you know that thing which you can understand figuratively a lot? Well, do you realize that his first bestowal actually made what is said there in Hebrews incredibly literal? So literal that we can basically just take what you say there in Hebrews and use it to describe what happened a billion years ago?
Because see, this is particularly true in one of the chapters or in several?
It's kind of, it repeats a lot. You know the way they love to write. They love to sort of repeat themselves. And so, you know, I believe, if I remember right, it's 5, 6, and 7 are the chapters of Hebrews that, you know, is doing that whole a priest forever of the order of Melchizedek discussion. You know, he actually literally was a Melchizedek, you know. I don't want to belabor that. Do this little research yourself. Go back and read that little passage of Hebrews and then think about this again. And it's like, wow, that's interesting. Chicken, egg. It's a fascinating thing to think about. How is it that has such incredible parallel? Besides, you know, the fact that, you know, the more you read about the Melchizedek's in here, the more you wonder where that stuff that's in the book of Hebrews came from. I mean, it obviously isn't just someone taking that one passage in Genesis and trying to spin a yarn relative to it, which they loved to do, you know, back in those days. The book of Hebrews is obviously bringing in some extra biblical oral tradition about the real Melchizedek. Down those 2,000 years. You know, the fact that he, you know, was born without mother and father, and those sorts of statements, you know, which the biblical scholars, you know, twist themselves into pretzels trying to rationalize away. That's coming down.
To the Melchizedek of Christ Michael's experience or Father Melchizedek?
No, I mean, it's obvious that in the book of Hebrews, whoever wrote that, you know, was aware of stories that were afoot amongst those peoples there in the Near East, that goes all the way back to Machaventa, right. You know, in 1980 BC.
But Chris, you remember the story. Yeah. Was it 500 BC or 560 BC that the Hebrew scribes removed all references or purposely left out all references to Melchizedek?
Except that one.
Yeah, except the one.
Right.
So there was a lot of oral tradition about Melchizedek, even
right. See, I mean, it's just that's all I'm trying to say. It's obvious that we've lost a whole bunch of, you know, 2,000 years ago. There obviously were a lot of things that were still known by people. Maybe they were not written down. I don't know, but either way, they were known by people. You know, and enough for whoever wrote that part of Hebrews, you know, put it in there. But we've lost all that. Now all we have is what's in the Bible, really. But clearly, there was a lot of remembrance of the actual Melchizedek story.
The other thing that's wonderful about this is that if you have in your mind the question of what are Melchizedeks like,
mm-hmm.
the fact that they appointed him chief of Melchizedeks, mm-hmm. and then right on the heels of that, they have a litany of characteristics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He faithfully performed his assignments. He was universally loved. Let's see, matchless wisdom, supreme love,
mm-hmm.
supreme devotion to duty. He loved us, understood us, and served us, and was loyal. I mean, that tells you in, you know, 7 or 8 qualities, mm-hmm. what a Melchizedek in the ideal
mm-hmm.
is all about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and one of the key things you might really kind of trigger off is that for matchless wisdom. They're going to really be impressed by his matchless wisdom, because remember, that's the one little Achilles heel, you know, that Melchizedek has. He doesn't have a big enough Achilles heel that he can go into rebellion. You know, but he can err. And it's in that issue. Sometimes in some Melchizedeks, there's a little blind spot relative to wisdom, and they have to kind of go back to finishing school. Remember that story about that? Yeah. See, so they're, you know, the fact that that's the first one they mention, he's related to that, they would be really, really enamored by that. It's like, oh, wow, he's just flawless in that, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So.
And that is all that I am permitted to tell you of the first bestowal of Michael. We, of course, fully understand that this strange Melchizedek, who so mysteriously served with Melchizedek a billion years ago, was none other than the incarnated Michael on the mission of his first bestowal. The records do not specifically state that this unique and efficient Melchizedek was Michael, but it is universally believed that he was one of those not-so-secret secrets. Probably the actual statement of that fact cannot be found outside the records of Sonorinton, and the records of that secret world are not open to us. Only on this sacred world of the Divine Sons are the mysteries of the incarnation and bestowal fully known. We all know of the facts of the Michael bestowals, but we do not understand how they are affected. We do not know how the ruler of a universe, the creator of the Melchizedek, can so suddenly and mysteriously become one of their number, and as one of them, live among them and work as a Melchizedek son for 100 years. But it so happened.
Okay, so, you know, again, it's pretty obvious. One of the things they're trying, you know, they're trying to stress, it's not just here in the seventh bestowal that you can put the word true in front of what he was. I mean, obviously he's true God, you know, by birth. But he was true man, you know, and he was true Melchizedek. Not just, you know, a crude facsimile of a Melchizedek. You know, you can tell by some of the words they say, you know, they sort of examine him with an electron microscope, you know. you know, he was true to the core. Everything about him was perfect Melchizedek. And not only that, but, I mean, absolutely like he was born here in this local universe, this type of Melchizedek. And so he was true Melchizedek. You know, you want to, you know, make that be a key thing that you take away from all this, because remember what we've tried to stress: when you say the word true, you're talking about conformal to the cosmos. If he wasn't a true Melchizedek, there's no way that this synchronization that we're talking about in this first one would have happened. He has to be perfectly conformal in order to be true and to sync up with that facet of the Supreme. Okay? So, to add that to, you know, the whole Jesus story, you know, I mean, on the one hand, from our point of view, it's really cool that he was true man, so that we can say, well, if he did it, I can do it too. You know, it may be difficult, but I know it's possible anyway. Yeah, there's that side of it. But think of it from his side too, see? He's true because he has to be true, or the synchronization will not happen. There's no way he'll pass muster with the Ancients of Days. It has to be true. Right, exactly. Good point. I mean, clearly, you don't need an Ancients of Day to figure out, you know, that, yeah, he was, you know, born as a babe, you know, and, you know, he's got, you know, all of the basic biology of a human and stuff. I mean, you know, and again, it's to try to challenge ourselves to not think of the word true in such simplistic terms. For you and I, you know, for you to actually have the audacity to say that you are true in some measure. See, don't let that be it's not about true and false questions, okay? That isn't what makes you true. If you get, you know, I mean, that's not even a correct usage of the words true and false. Mm-hmm. It should be correct and incorrect. And yeah. Those questions don't have anything to do with true and false. They have to do with correct and incorrect. True and false are a much bigger thing. Okay? To be true is to be synchronized with you know, this facet of the threefold actuality, which is above and beyond being synchronized with the factual facet. The true and false questions is about synchronizing, is it fact or figment? You know? That's not what that's about.
It seems like true relates to love and devotion. Because wherever he goes, people love him and are devoted to him and adore him. And they use those words.
Yeah, I mean, notice they said supreme love. See, he had this cosmic character that was so vast, there's only one word that describes it, supreme. But you and I, you know, it'll be a long time before we can say that, you know, that what we are is supreme. But
well,
we can say
it inspires
right.
them to love him
right.
and be devoted.
Yeah, and what I'm trying to get is to bring it back to you. What could you manifest that would inspire others the same way?
Right.
You obviously are not going to do the supreme thing.
No.
But you can do the cosmic thing.
I can try.
Which just means you haven't taken it all the way to the margins of the finite domain. But within the limits of the finite that you are, or that the circumstance is, if you manifest a cosmic character within that little sphere, that will get people's attention. It will be something that they are unfamiliar with. It will be peace that passes all understanding, for instance, you know, or anything like that. That's the fifth ethical revelation is challenging us to try to do that. Pick a little sphere and be cosmic within it. Tune yourself to the cosmos within it. And that's not about the Father. That's about the Mother. The Father initiates your ability to do that. But he doesn't automatically make you do that, you know, make you something that is that or does that. He just gives you the potential to do that. To actually do that, you have to synchronize with some measure of the Mother.
That's an everyday process.
I mean, the reason that the supreme is because the supreme synchronizes with the full measure of the Mother. That's what makes supreme supreme.
the one thing that's kind of remarkable here is just that, you know, I mean, 100 years may seem like a long time for us, but for a Melchizedek,
yeah,
you know, and for them to say, oh, you know, in that brief period of time,
mm-hmm.
He distinguished himself to the point where it's obvious we've got to make him the head guy,
yeah.
You know, forever. Whether or not they knew, and they probably did pretty soon, who he actually was, that was a bestowal mission.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, what the rest of the, you know, it's kind of unsaid, but everybody knew it.
Yeah.
But still, you know, it wasn't like, oh, he's the sovereign, we got to give him this credit.
Mm-hmm.
No, he actually distinguished himself in a short period of time.
Right. And there you know why he was so mysterious when he left. Okay? He wanted them to discover him as he was.
Who do you say that I
am? You know, he wanted them to see that the symphony was beautiful because the symphony is beautiful, not because of who wrote the symphony. He wanted them to have an objective relationship to it. Like they said, I mean, there's an awful lot of things going on with these bestowals that goes beyond Michael.
Sure.
Yeah, and that's an example of one of them. But anyway, you get the point. I mean, just that one bestowal, and we could mine it for more. But see, just how once you bring in a little bit of the bigger picture, you're looking for a lot more into it. That's why I wanted to, you know, do this first before we read about the bestowals, before we even talked about, you know, was he a Melchizedek or a Melchizedek? Because see, you're immediately getting into facts and stuff. You want to get a bigger picture first so that you can try to find the truth that flows through it. Something that, see, whenever we find a little thread of truth, it's almost impossible for us to stop talking in 2 hours' time. Because it's like, oh, let's follow that some more. Master, can we just build a tabernacle here and stay here forever? See, that's the mode that you want to get into with the revelation, where it's just, you just want to follow it and follow it because you're moving. You can tell you're moving. Okay? It's not just words. And the only way to get that is to have some bigger picture in play before you dig in. And there's just endless questions that are unanswered that you could pursue. you know, this obviously is telling you a lot more about Melchizedek. You know?
Once again, the book is new.
No. You know, what are the Melchizedek's relationship?
Of 119.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, each one of the things tells you which attendant. And then a paragraph in, at the end of the paper tells you this, you know, which master spirit goes with which one. Yeah. All those facts are just right there. All I did is just took them out and put them onto a page so you can see them in front of you. And soon if you put them all in one spot, you go, whoa, that's not random, is it? There's a whole bunch of patterns there. That was the point.
Chris,
can I say one
more thing? Yep, okay. It seems like that the stones make like an opening for us that wasn't there. It makes it maybe just a little easier to try to emulate mm-hmm. what he does.
Yep. Right.
And maybe in a more significant way than I can even imagine.
Yeah.
It's like a, I can't really describe it, like a pathway that opens up.
Yeah, and because the initial things are made more accessible by what he's done, guess what that means? That means you have to go farther. As, you know, you're getting a big chunk more by grace. Mm-hmm. That to whom much is given is much expected. You know, for you to fuse during this life is a much bigger challenge than it was, you know, for Enoch. Because you have a whole bunch of stuff that he didn't have to start with. So you can't just do what he did. You have to build upon, you know, what you have now, like he built upon what he had then. You know, and it's sad to record that, that most people are functioning at a level that's less than what he had to start with. Let alone trying to even achieve the level that he achieved when he fused, which won't get you to fuse. But, I mean, this is, you know, the Supreme has moved on since Enoch, you know. And so, and like you're just saying, that really affects us much more definitively than it did before because Michael has tied us to the Supreme much more intimately than 2,000 years ago, we were tied to the Supreme because he's given us the Spirit of Truth and he's tied to the Supreme and the Spirit is tied to him. So we're tied to the Supreme. See, there's a much more expected of us
now. Consciousness of it.
Yeah.
And we do.
Yeah. For us to be below Enoch is alarming.
It's so alarming that they mustered the, you know, the revelators and gave us an emergency revelation. It's like, guys, here, this is really getting minimal here. Just those are the kind of things to think about. I mean, this is, when he gave us the Spirit of Truth, that's, that really upped the ante. I mean, you got to really, you know, bring your A game if you're going to play now. This is not penny ante, you know, world anymore. You know, this is
not
a,
the harbor
right. You know, if you don't want to be sad to record, you're going to have to really take it up a notch. Just being, you know, we've talked about that a million times. So you're going to really appreciate it, literally now.
Take it up a notch. Yep. Chris
Halverson. Okay. Even though it seemed like we, you know, only got through one section, it's actually good. Good place because it's good to do the next two together because they very much go together. Yeah, so we didn't have to break separate two and three so far apart by a week. It'll be good to do two and three together. I was actually hoping it turned out this way tonight. I was thinking about it, and you know, because you remember that two and three are about him engaging the prior two rebellions, and so it's good to talk about those. Good to talk about those together. Let's take a moment here and settle in.
About those 24 missions in 100 years.
Oh, yeah.
He's doing these.
Yeah.
I mean, in possibly 4 years of that time.
Yeah, I mean, in relative terms, Malkavent and Melchizedek did one mission in the same period of time. He did 24 in that span of time. He was an overachiever, see, again. No wonder they were so impressed by him.
But during the Beast Stall.
Were they suspecting, or was it still
ambiguous? As you can see, this one, it was, you know, it was pretty ambiguous. You know, after this one,
things were like, gelling.
I think I know what's going on here. Yeah, it was. Yeah,
I've seen this once before.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a moment here.